A reading from the book of Genesis, chapter 45, verses 1 through 21. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me. You, your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all you have. I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it is really I who am speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honor accorded me in Egypt and about everything you have seen, and bring my father down here quickly.' Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him, weeping. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterward, his brothers talked with him. When the news reached Pharaoh's palace that Joseph's brothers had come, Pharaoh and all his officials were pleased. Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Tell your brothers, do this. Load your animals and return to the land of Canaan, and bring your father and your families back to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. You are also directed to tell them, do this. Take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives, and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings, because the best of all Egypt will be yours.' So the sons of Israel did this. Joseph gave them carts, as Pharaoh had commanded, and he also gave them provisions for their journey." The word of the Lord.
Well, good evening. As Susan mentioned, my name is Bijan, one of the pastors on the West Side, and very glad to be here with you this evening. Now, for the past few weeks, we've been in a series entitled Blessed to be a Blessing. And each week we've taken a look at a passage from the book of Genesis, noticing that when God is at work in someone's life, he's often working in them, through them, and sometimes even in spite of them, in order to bless others. The blessing of God comes not as an end in itself, but so that we might bless those around us. And today we come to the very middle of the story of Joseph. A couple weeks ago, we began that story in Genesis 37. And tonight, we resume this study. And what I want to show you here in chapter 45 is what you might call a case study in applied theology. A case study of applied theology, that is, this passage shows us what it means to take an aspect of biblical teaching, a doctrine, and then to put it at work in your life in a way that's both personal and practical. This is relevant for those who identify as Christians, and I would say also especially for those who are here tonight evaluating Christianity. What does it mean to take the truth of the Christian faith and put it at work in your life? And so we're going to look at this passage, and I want to show you first what happened, second, why it happened, and then last, how it can happen in your life. What happened, why it happened, and how it can unfold in your life. So first, what happened? You see it there in verses 14 and 15. The sons of Jacob are reconciled. There is reconciliation. You see there in the text, Joseph with his brothers, they come together. He's revealed himself to them. There is talking, there is weeping, and there is embracing. The relationship that was previously fractured has been repaired, it's been healed. And so the what happened is reconciliation. Now it's possible for the force of that to not land on you because we come to this story right in the middle. But to understand how amazing it is that reconciliation between these guys has actually taken place, we have to summarize briefly the earlier part of the story. In Genesis 37, we learn about Jacob and at that time, his 11 sons. Joseph is one of the youngest and he's a favorite of his father. And his older brothers don't like that. They're angry and they're jealous of this younger brother who gets all the father's attention. And so, one day the older brothers are out tending their flocks in their field in the wilderness. And Jacob says to Joseph, go check on the welfare of your brothers. Go see how they're doing. So Joseph makes his way to where they are. And as they see him coming off in the distance, their hearts are angered. Because again, they don't like him. They're jealous of him. He gets on their nerves. And so it's at such a point that they plot together, let's just kill him. Let's be done with him. Let's get him out of our life. And that's what they're about to do when one of the older brothers actually intervenes and says, hey, wait, let's not kill him. Off in the distance, I see a caravan that looks like it's going down to Egypt. Let's just sell him into slavery. This way we won't have his blood on our hands and we'll actually make a little profit. So they agree, that's our plan. And Joseph is sold by his brothers into slavery. Joseph is taken to Egypt. He becomes a slave in the house of a man named Potiphar. He's doing his best with what he has. But one day, you can read about this in the later parts of the 30s there in Genesis, he's falsely accused while he's there in Potiphar's house, wrongfully charged. And as a result, he's sent to prison. And he goes to this prison there in Egypt, now in a dungeon. But while there, he makes a couple of friends. He meets a cupbearer and a baker who used to work for Pharaoh. And he becomes friends with them. One night, both of those guys on the same night have a dream, two different dreams, but they have dreams. And they come to Joseph in the morning. And they say, we've had these dreams. We don't know what they mean. And Joseph says, don't worry. Interpretation belongs to God. Tell me your dreams and God will give you their meaning. So as this happens, you can read about it. Joseph interprets the cupbearer's dream. It's good news for him. He's actually going to be released from the prison and restored to his position in Pharaoh's court. Not such good news for the baker. You can read about that. But Joseph says to the cupbearer as he's being released from the prison, remember me. Remember me when you stand in the presence of Pharaoh. I don't belong to be here. I haven't done anything deserving of being not only in prison, but a slave. Remember me when you get to Pharaoh's court. But as the story goes on, Joseph is forgotten about. Until a couple years go by, and one night Pharaoh has a dream, and he's troubled, he's anxious about it. And the cupbearer remembers, yes, there's someone in the prison. Joseph, he can give interpretation of dreams. So Pharaoh summons Joseph, Pharaoh lays out his dream, and Joseph says, here is its interpretation. 7 years of agricultural abundance is coming. There's going to be crops in plenty. That's good news. But the bad news is after that, there will be 7 years of tremendous famine, like the world has never seen. And so Joseph says to Pharaoh, you need to plan wisely during the 7 years of abundance so that we're cared for during the 7 years of famine. So Pharaoh looks around and says, who am I going to get to do that job? And then he appoints Joseph. And so Joseph goes from the prison to effectively what is a prime minister kind of role there in Egypt. Now, once we get into the time of famine, everybody in that region is needing food. And so one day when the sons of Jacob, Joseph's brothers, run out of food in the land that they're living in, Jacob says to them, "Go to Egypt. We've heard there's food there. Buy grain for us that we might live." So they make their way down to Egypt, and they go and they stand in line to buy food from none other than their brother. They don't recognize him, but Joseph immediately does. And you can read about this in the early part of the 40s there in Genesis. They're engaging with one another. The brothers don't know, but Joseph does. But here in chapter 45, he's finally, for the first time, revealing himself, with the result being that this relationship that was fractured and broken ends up healed and there's reconciliation. So that's the story. And so what I want to say first, if that's what happened, reconciliation, how did it come about? The first thing to point out, and we'll be brief here, is what did the brothers do to contribute towards reconciliation? And I'll say this pretty briefly because it's actually in chapter 44. The brothers confess their sin. I think on the path towards reconciliation, on the path towards healing in relationship, confession and taking ownership of your actions is a necessary part. You can read about this in 44:16. The brothers confess. They don't know they're talking to Joseph, but they confess their sin. They're honest about what they did, and they're taking ownership for their actions. So there's confession. But for the purposes of our study tonight, what is it that Joseph does in order to engage in reconciliation? Two things. On one hand, he chooses not to take revenge. He foregoes any opportunity to be vengeful. And then on the other hand, instead of showing revenge, he shows forgiveness. Not taking revenge and showing forgiveness. Let me unpack each of those. Whenever you've been hurt, the natural impulse of our hearts is to take revenge. That is to even the score. An eye for an eye. A couple years ago, there was an article in the Times entitled, "Why Does Revenge Taste So Sweet?" And the author said this, quote, "The best way to understand revenge is that it's a deeply human behavior. That urge to extract a pound of flesh is primed in our genes." And so this explains why many people who think that they're above taking revenge actually find themselves doing nasty and despicable things. The author is saying it's primed in the genes. The natural impulse of our hearts when we've been wronged is to get even, to settle the score. I remember about 2 years ago thinking about this topic, revenge, and watching a baseball game. And I realized that revenge is in my heart deeply, because here's what happened. If you're a baseball fan, or lots of sports have similar kinds of things, you know that on occasion between teams there's rivalry and tension. And so every once in a while, the pitcher of one team will take the baseball and at great speed hurl it purposefully at the batter of another team with the purpose of pegging him, of hitting him. Now, when that happens, if the team that I support is up to bat and one of my guys gets beamed, you know what immediately happens in my heart? What I immediately start saying to myself, just wait, because pretty soon we'll be pitching. And you can bet we'll be throwing back at you. Now, mind you, I'm sitting on my couch. I have nothing to do with this. And yet I feel identified with the wrong that's been committed. And I want the score to be settled. An eye for an eye. You throw at us, we'll throw at you. It's revenge. And it's the natural impulse of my heart. Of course, there are much more serious ways in which this manifests itself in our lives. Someone hurls, not a baseball, but an insult in your direction, and we respond in kind, throwing insults back at them. Someone at work, a colleague, damages your reputation, and you're constantly then looking for subtle or not so subtle ways to damage theirs. Perhaps there's been a relationship in your life and you've been betrayed, you've been hurt. And so even if outwardly you pretend like everything's fine, all is well, inwardly you're rooting for their demise. You may not want to attack them, but you sure hope somebody else does. These are all different ways in which revenge, which is natural in our heart, manifests itself in our lives. And so we can ask, if revenge is in fact natural, why not take it? If it's the natural impulse, why not engage in it? And the answer is, on one hand, we can affirm, yeah, it's good to be angry at injustice, sure. But revenge is what happens when that natural anger at injustice grows to an inordinate proportion and you take matters into your own hands. And the result is revenge never really satisfies. It doesn't actually even the score. It simply prolongs the pain and makes the gash deeper. Lewis Smedes is an ethicist, and talking about this, he said, quite vividly, I think, the problem with revenge is that it never evens the score. It ties both the injured and the injurer to an escalator of pain. Both are stuck on that escalator as long as parity is demanded. The escalator never stops. Revenge doesn't work. It doesn't actually settle anything. It just makes matters intense, deeper, widens the gap, and it destroys you, the person taking the revenge. Anne Lamott in Traveling Mercies said this very vivid image that I find quite unpleasant, and so it stuck with me. She said, taking revenge is like drinking rat poison and then waiting for the rat to die. That's what revenge does to you. And so that's what Joseph in this passage chooses not to do. And you know, I think if you read through the Joseph narrative, you'll see that there are a lot of tests. There are a lot of moments in which his faith is challenged. I think this is his greatest test. He stands in front of these guys who hurt him so deeply, and he has great power. He's prime minister of all Egypt. He can do with them as he pleases. I think that's his greatest test. And he foregoes the opportunity to take revenge. But what does he do instead? Forgiveness. He shows them forgiveness. It's undergirding all of his actions throughout the narrative. And so we ask now, what is forgiveness? Whenever a wrong has been committed against you, it's as if a moral, or you might say an ethical debt, has been incurred. And to forgive someone means, rather than making them pay for what they've done, you absorb the cost yourself. So we've used this example here at Redeemer. I think it's helpful. Let's say I invite you over to my apartment, and while there, you break a lamp. Now, at that moment, a couple of things can happen. You can say, I'm so sorry about that. Let me pay for it. And I say, okay, it costs this much. Thanks for paying me for it. And then I go buy a new lamp. Or you could say, hey, where'd you get that lamp? I'll go buy you a new one. And you go buy me a new lamp, and you bring it to me, and I've got my lamp. But if you say, oh, I'm so sorry, that was so terrible, and I say, don't worry about it, I forgive you, well, what happens? Either I go and buy myself a new lamp, or I have less light in my apartment. But in order to forgive you, I have to actually absorb the cost myself. A lamp doesn't just suddenly reappear. Somebody has to pay. And forgiveness means that rather than making somebody pay for the wrong they've done towards you, you absorb it yourself. That's forgiveness. And what does this look like as we flesh it out in our lives? What does it look like for Joseph? Well, it means on one hand, refusing to use what that person has done to harm you as leverage in the future, holding it over them constantly, always bringing it up when something goes bad. Refusing to use it as leverage. It means also refusing to cut that person down by engaging in slander and backbiting and gossip. And it must mean also, and this is perhaps the most challenging, refusing to indulge in ill will in your heart, quietly rooting for something terrible to come upon that person. Forgiveness must mean absorbing all that such that you forego those practices. That's forgiveness. And you can see that's awfully hard. And that's why many people writing about forgiveness note it's not just an event. You don't just forgive somebody and poof, everything's better. It's as much an event as it is a process. It's an ongoing activity. And you know, next week during the sermon here, you'll be looking at Genesis 50, which is in many ways a parallel passage to this one, in which Joseph is once again reminding his brothers of his forgiveness. Why? Because they're wondering about it. Maybe he needs to remind himself. It's ongoing in its nature. It's a process and it's an event. So that's what happened. Reconciliation. The brothers confess. Joseph doesn't take revenge, but he forgives instead. But that leads me to ask, why could this happen? What is it that was in Joseph's heart and mind that enabled him to forgive the people who hurt him so deeply? What is it that he knew? What resources did he have at his disposal that enabled him to forgive like this? Why could this happen? And the reason is, in this moment, Joseph is taking doctrine, something he believes, and he's putting it into practice in his life. You see it right there in verse 5. This is probably the heart of the entire, maybe, book of Genesis, certainly the Joseph narrative. But in verse 5, Joseph is talking to his brothers, and he says, because they're terrified, they're scared, what's he going to do to us? Joseph says to them, "It was God who sent me here to Egypt." Now that should jolt you as you read that. You should be stunned in your chair. Wait a second, Joseph, what do you mean it was God? It wasn't God. It was your brothers who were wicked. It was Potiphar's house and the evil that befell you there. It was the cupbearer who forgot about you. It was all these people who did terrible things. They're responsible for your fate. Joseph is emphatic, not just verse 5. Look at 7 and 8. "It was God who sent me ahead of you. It was not you who put me here, but God." And not only does Joseph affirm God is the author of the activity of his life, but he also sees not just that God brought him to the place that he's in, but God is working for good, not just his personal good, but the good of many in his situation. So he says, "God sent me to save your lives, to bring about great good." It was for redemption. It was for salvation. It was so that we might have food, and not just us, but all people. God did this, and he did it for good. And so, because he says it much more eloquently than I can, Gerhard von Rad, who has a commentary on the book of Genesis, writes this to summarize this idea. Here we have the climax of the story. We see that God had all the strings in his hand, and the guidance of God incorporated man's evil into his saving activity. The point of the story is that God overcomes evil not merely by stopping it, but by so thwarting its destructive purposes that it's actually used to further God's saving objective. You hear what he's saying? God's absolute overcoming of evil is not just putting it to an end, but actually, though he'll do that, but it's actually taking what was intended for evil and using it to accomplish good. I mean, that's the end of evil. And Joseph says, that's what God has been doing in my life. Yes, you were the human cause of my calamity, but God was the one who sent me here, and he did it to bring about much good. Now, many, many, many years later, theologians would summarize this kind of doctrine and others throughout the Bible under the heading providence. This is the Christian idea of providence, that the hidden hand of God is always at work in the ordinary affairs of human life. In some invisible and mysterious way, God is always governing all creatures, all actions, and all circumstances. This is the biblical doctrine of providence. Now, I must be clear, this in no way means that Joseph's brothers are not responsible for their actions. They are. I've already shown you that they've confessed their sin. And what's more, you know, it would be possible, though wrong, to read something like this and hear a sermon like this and say, okay, so it doesn't matter what I do because God's just going to always use it for good. The point of the Joseph narrative and the parts of other parts of the Bible that talk about this is these guys cause great pain, tremendous agony and suffering because of their actions. They thought they would get more love from their father by getting rid of their brother of whom they were jealous. They ended up getting less of their father. They couldn't even begin to fathom the weight of guilt and shame that they would have because of what they did. This is a story of sadness and suffering. And yet, it's also a story that shows us in the midst of it all, even with evil human intention, the purposes of God cannot be thwarted, and he actually takes what man meant for evil and transforms it and uses it to bring about the saving of many lives to accomplish good. What does this mean practically? What does it mean for Joseph? What does it mean for you and I? It means that patiently, slowly, gently, we can actually begin to reinterpret our own narratives. We can actually look at our life story, especially the parts that have been jarring and painful, and begin to look to a God that works not just in spite of those things, but through those things. One other commentator writing about this says, "From a worm's eye view, Joseph's narrative reads like a nightmare, a cacophony of outrageous excesses unjustly inflicted upon him. And so a rational conclusion from this perspective would be that everything is absurd. It could have made Joseph a cynic. But he chooses instead this heavenly perspective that God, however mysterious, is working through him to bring about what is good. And that enables him to forgive his brothers." The force of this narrative, friends, is not to minimize the suffering that we've experienced, but it is to allow you, even to invite you, to begin to look at and reinterpret what you've experienced, inviting you to see how God might be at work, trusting him. And slowly, patiently, this allows you to begin engaging in the difficult work of forgiveness. And so lastly, I will ask, well, how do we actually put this into practice in our lives? And I have to affirm at this point that many of us are in different places. You know, when you read a story like this, some of us immediately identify with Joseph. We feel like we've been wronged, we've been hurt, and we're struggling with knowing how to forgive. Others, though, identify with the brothers. We're the ones who are steamrolling people. We're the ones who are doing the harm. There are some of us here tonight who are, appropriately so, responding cynically. We're skeptical. This whole providence stuff, God is always working, taking bad stuff and making it for good. How could that be? It's not been the story of my life. And so we're all in different places as we respond to this kind of narrative. And the way in which I think we take a text like this and keep it from being just another religious fable that inspires us for about 15 minutes but doesn't actually work in the real world, the way I think we avoid that is by recognizing that Joseph's story is actually our story. Joseph's story, you might say it like this, is merely a pointer of another story that encompasses each one of us. Think about it. Think again about this story. The beloved son of the father is sent away from home to check on the welfare of his brothers. But when he arrives, instead of getting acceptance, he's rejected. He's mocked, he's scorned. Ultimately, he's condemned to die because of false, trumped-up charges. And then in that moment of great need, in that moment of great agony, this beloved son of the father says to those closest to him, "Remember me," only to be betrayed and to be forgotten. Whose story am I talking about? Yes, Joseph. But Joseph's story is merely a pointer to the ultimate story of the gospel, the story of Jesus Christ. Everything that I've just described happened in the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus. And we have to affirm, who was responsible for Jesus's death? Peter, one of the earliest leaders in the Christian church, preaching a sermon in Acts 2, said this. He was talking to the people who were responsible for Jesus's crucifixion. He says to them, "Jesus was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan. And you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross." And so we ask Peter, we ask the Bible, who is responsible for Jesus's death? Was it wicked people or was it God himself? And the answer must be yes. You might say the cross is the ultimate example of providence in which God reaches in to the evil, wicked acts of human beings to bring about not just good, but the saving, redemptive good that would ultimately heal the whole world. And it's our story. Because it wasn't just they who caused Jesus' crucifixion. It was my sin. It was our sin upon his shoulders. We sold our elder brother Jesus into slavery. He stood in that place for us. The Joseph story is our story. We've been forgiven by the one who bore our evil. That story is our story. And so what we have here in Genesis is a pretty vivid illustration of Romans 8:28. All things working together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Earlier today, at the end of the beginning part of our worship service, we sang here a song that was actually originally a poem by an 18th century poet, also a Christian, William Cowper. William Cowper was, as I've mentioned, a Christian, but also someone who suffered throughout his life with great despair and depression. He lost his mom at the age of 6. He lost 2 siblings shortly thereafter. He had tremendous heartbreak in relationships, was thwarted in many of his career attempts, tremendous despair and discouragement and depression throughout his life. And yet, at one point, he wrote a poem that for 2 centuries has been encouraging Christians, many people. The title is God Moves in a Mysterious Way. And 2 stanzas of that poem say this: "Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break with blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace, because behind his frowning providence, he hides his smiling face. Behind a frowning providence, he hides his smiling face." We know that not just because of the Joseph narrative, but because of the cross. And so, friends, tonight I say to you, gaze once again upon Jesus, upon our great elder brother, who not just at great expense, but at the very cost of his life, came to rescue me, came to rescue you, to bring us home. Gaze upon that, see God at work. And slowly, gradually, that confidence and that trust will enable you to see God always working, no matter what's taking place in your life. And then even in the pain, gradually, not perfectly, but we'll even be able to pursue reconciliation with those who have hurt us as we engage in forgiveness. Let's pray together. Our Father, we thank you for these incredibly encouraging stories and more for your Son to whom they all point. Help us this night even once again to see Jesus afresh, to experience grace, that we might be changed from the inside out, that we might be transformed into a people that no matter what we're going through, can have a deep confidence in you and a love and a spirit of forgiveness for those around us. May that be for your glory, for our good and the good of those around us. We pray this together in Jesus' name. Amen.